Thank you very much for the introduction, and I have to thank the organizers for letting me present this work here. This is actually the work of two PhD students, mostly so Thomas Ferrin and Sarah Angel, I should say, who finished their PhD in 2017, and they actually did their PhD partly in the framework of an A&R that was awarded to Alexandre Choubnel. So, and yeah, I listed here like many people, and there are even many more who have been working on this project from closer or farther. So we've seen this picture already, and especially this one that is actually from Froelich in 1989. And this number of earthquakes per year as a function of the frequency of earthquakes as a function of depth in the earth is actually a problem from the mechanical point of view, because after a few gigapascals, after a few tens of kilometers depth within the earth, one should not find rocks that are deforming in a brittle-like manner, because the energy required to break these rocks is actually much higher than the energy that it requires to flow. So just the rocks should be quietly flowing. And as Blandine Gardonio showed this morning, they are not so quiet even at very large depths. So, and because of the location of these earthquakes, so this was the picture of the workshop, but there are many more studies. Because of the location of these earthquakes, and which are mostly in subduction zones, and which seem to delineate some stability field of some minerals that are undergoing some transformations in the subducting slabs, people have been proposing for decades that these earthquakes could be induced somehow by mineralogical reactions. So that's one hypothesis, of course, and there are others. And also one question I'm going to actually talk about first is how can we test for this experimentally? So before doing that, I will just go into already some information that we've already seen actually on intermediate depth earthquakes, because these are the ones that I'm going to talk about. In subduction zones, this is an example in northeast Japan, and what you see in a lot of places around the Earth is that you have two seismic zones in these subducting slabs, which are separated by tens of kilometers, 30 kilometers about. And these double seismic zones actually seem to coincide with some reactions that are in the downgoing slab. So here, for instance, it seems to coincide with reactions from blue schist to an eclogite for the top seismic plane. And for the lower seismic plane, people have been advocating that this could be the result of dehydration reactions because the mantle in this slab could be hydrated. So of course, as it was already mentioned this morning, this is a hypothesis, and we are not sure that the mantle can be hydrated down to these depths. But still, this is something that we can test for experimentally. And so the other hypotheses actually include the intrinsic mechanical properties of the dry mantle here. And this, of course, I'm not going to talk about this. And in terms of processes that can occur in this during these mineralogical reactions, what could trigger a mechanical instability? Well, it could be that the grain sizes that are produced during these reactions are very small. And it could also be that you get, so you can even have amorphization, and it could also be that you release some fluid and you have a decrease in effective pressure because, this, because of this large amount of fluid. So of course, this is not always a valid mechanism because of thermodynamic properties. So before going into the experiment of Thomas on that topic, I would like to talk about how we can investigate brittle-like behavior under high pressures. And there are several ways to do that. Nicolas Brantu has shown that already in some apparatus. And The previous talk also showed a different way of doing that, and this is so yet another way to do that, still using some acoustic emission measurements. So first, how do we generate large pressures under and deformation? This is an apparatus that allows you to go to higher pressures, compared to the previous talk. So this will bring you to about 20 gigapascals on a good day, so you can also investigate the problems of the, deeper earthquakes. It's a multi-anvil press that is made for deformation of materials. So the way it works is you have a sample that is a few cubic millimeters, so that is even smaller than what you have seen previously. And it is within a confining medium that is this cube here, and you have a furnace to heat the sample. And this confining medium with the sample goes in between six anvils that are going to press on the sample and impose some pressure. Now you can control also the top and the bottom anvil to shorten the sample, for instance. And this will allow you to do some deformation under the pressures of the Earth's mantle. So the nice thing about this is you can add, actually, if you have a transparent environment for your sample, an X-ray transparent environment for your sample, you can add in-situ monitoring using synchrotron X-rays. And so the X-rays are going to cross the pressure transmitting medium, the sample, and get some diffraction signal, for instance. And the good thing about that is we can measure this diffraction and from this recover some information on the stresses and the reaction progress within the material. So what you will access with this kind of thing, which is the analysis of the diffraction signal that is here, you can access the crystals and the phases stresses rather than the force over a surface. And this is a very important difference between this setup and the other ones. And you will also access the reaction progress because this diffraction signal here has signal that comes from the, here it's an example on an antigorite and olivine, so polyphased aggregate. And you have signal coming from the olivine and signal coming from the serpentine. So now, as I said already, how can we listen to rocks using this high-pressure device? The way to do it is one way to do it is to add acoustic emission monitoring. And so this was done. This setup was done in 2010 when Alex Rubnell first came to the APS. And the way it works is you have a piezo transducer that is in the back of each of these six anvils. So it's like having six seismic stations that are listening to your sample that is in this little cube here. So sample is the green thing. And this transducer transforms the elastic wave that comes from the sample into an electrical signal that is amplified and recorded. What is not shown here is there is also a continuous recording possibility on this setup, and this allows you to have a kind of catalog of your acoustic emission events, and therefore to have statistics that are not biased by some recording in the dead time in the system. So we did a proof of concept study a while ago now. It was on metastable olivine transformation to a spinel form in an analog system. Why an analog? Because it was technically too complex to do at this time to work on the real system. And what you see here is the differential stress as a function of time in black here. The blue here is the strain over time, and the red here is the acoustic emission rate. So we compressed the sample and deformed it to get some stress on it at some temperature, and then we heat it to cross the transition. When we crossed the transition, the acoustic emission rate increased and even accelerated, and eventually we got a stress drop and an increase in strain rate, and that was a sample failure. So, of course, you need to prove that this is coming from the sample. So there was some post-experiment tomographies on the sample and that highlighted that we have some cross-cutting faults within the recovered samples. And recently, some people using double difference techniques relocated the acoustic emissions. And you can see that the location of these acoustic events within the sample correlate pretty well with the faults that cross-cut the sample. So, and lastly, as I was telling you, we can do some unbiased statistics on the acoustic events, and this is what was done at this time. And so magnitudes were really calculated for these different acoustic emissions. These two are saturated, actually, the system. And you can recalculate a number of events, as classified them as a function of the magnitude, and the slope, actually, of this distribution is below minus one. And basically, it means that this is close to a Gutenberg-Richter law. So meaning we have something that might be a self-similar process, and maybe we are looking at something that is that we can extrapolate from the lab to the actual earthquakes. So that was the proof of concept experiment. What Thomas Ferrand did during his PhD was to work on this dehydration serpentine problem and its possible relation to the lower Vadetti Benioff plane. Here you have seen this picture already, just to remind us that, or a similar one, that the location of some earthquakes in terms of pressure and temperature actually end around the Antigorite dehydration reaction. So, as the previous talk also presented, the problem of the mechanical stability of serpentinite when it dehydrates and when it is under stress, it has been investigated already, and these authors, among others, proposed that the fluid release causes dehydration and brittlement. And on the contrary, more recent studies have shown, and in several ways, that this behavior, this mechanical behavior, seems stable during the dehydration. So here we had a kind of discrepancy, and we were wondering, okay, what is the reason for that? And one possible reason was that in most of these studies, actually, the last ones used pure Antigorite aggregates, and the ones before were using some aggregates that were actually that had either a certain fair amount of another phase, or a microstructure that was a microstructure that was not like so homogeneous. So one possibility was that the different phases were inducing something, and that was leading to these discrepancies in the experimental results. So Thomas did some experiments. He started his PhD by preparing some synthetic peridotite. So this is powder. I hope nobody will scream at me for doing that. And these were powders with a different amounts of serpentine and olivine, so 50% serpentine and 50% olivine, 20% serpentine, 5% and a full olivine aggregate. And he wanted to look at the differences in the behavior of this aggregate. So this is a starting material. One thing that you have to know is when we are doing this experiment, depending on the speed at which you are doing the experiment, the reactions that you cross will be a bit different. Here is the pressure and temperature stability field of Antigorite, and actually, if you heat slowly, there is a field in which you will start dehydrating the Antigorite and create a number of hydrous phases here before you actually end to the olivine and pyroxene aggregate at higher temperatures. So this first reaction here releases only a small amount of fluid, and the second one releases a lot of fluid. So the experiments of Thomas were actually starting to deform at some temperature and pressure, and then once we got some stress, heat it to induce the dehydration. What I also should mention is that the rate of heating over strain rate is about 1200 Kelvin, so this is below the study that you have seen just previously. So we are well within the range of subducting slabs in that, at least in that kind of parameters. So these are the mechanical results. There are many things here. So on the left-hand side, you have the experiments for the low confining pressure. So he actually did experiments at lower and higher confining pressure, so 1 gigapascal and 3.5 gigapascal. Confining pressure here is the mean stress. And this is the differential stress that was recorded using X-ray diffraction. And in the lower part here is the cumulative number of acoustic emission. Everything is as a function of strain during the experiment. And you have the temperature increase here in gray. What you see here is that low pressures only experiment with 5% antigorite in the starting aggregate gave acoustic emissions. While the experiment at a higher confining pressure, here 3.5 gigapascal, all of the sample gave acoustic emissions. So what is interesting to note here is these are one and two are the places where these two dehydration reactions I was talking before are supposed to happen. So as for the olivine here, we also got some acoustic emissions. This is probably due to some stress reorganization within the sample because it got a lot of strain hardening at the beginning. This is something we can talk more later, but we decided to kind of leave this aside, also because the microstructures are different. And what happens during the 5 and 20% serpentine is in green and orange, and you can see that they have acoustic emissions that correlate to some extent with these two dehydration reactions. So looking in another way at this data, this is reported as in a pressure-temperature kind of phase diagram for antigorite. And this again are the first dehydration reaction. And this is where the second should happen. He reported here the acoustic emissions with a scale, circles are scaling with the number of acoustic emissions recorded. At low pressures, this occurred at the same time as everything went into dehydration. And at the highest pressure, you got these two kind of places, especially in the 20% antigorite sample, where this acoustic emission occurred. And they actually correlate these first ones here with the place where we saw the talc appearing on the diffraction. So this is a big advantage of this kind of setup, is you can see whenever your phase is starting to grow. Here the second correlated up to the end of the existence of the antigorite in the aggregate. In terms of statistics, he was able, even if the number of events was much less than in the work on the olivine to spinel phase transition, to do some statistics. And here what you have as a slope is 0.6. So it's, again, very close to what we can expect for real earthquakes. And in terms of microstructures, I will just show this one because this is maybe the most striking one. This is with a 5% antigorite sample at 1.1 gigapascal. And these pictures are taken from this place of the sample where you have some cracks that are cross-cutting, so that are roughly oriented this way. And this fault here from a close view shows a displacement. It also shows some features that he actually called injectites, and the reason for that is also because of what was observed in the FIB section. This is a TM pictures of what you see if you go closer into this fault, and what you will see is some vesicles, so that traduced that you had some fluids actually escaping the minerals. And what you have here is a diffraction on this area G, where is it? It's here. And this diffraction tells you that you have some nanocrystalline material, so very, very small grains, and amorphous material in this location with the vesicles. So, and what I should show also is this, which was probably the most beautiful of this microstructural study. This is a neoformed olivine grain, so which was found in this injectite here. So what it means is that the olivine was molten and recrystallized within this experimental injectite. So Thomas came up with a model for explaining this all these experimental observations, and he called this dehydration-driven stress transfer. The idea behind this is that the anti-chloride stress goes to zero when it's close to dehydration, and actually, if you look carefully, this is something that you can see on the diffractions. Here, he are represented aggregates with 5, 10, and 20% anti-chloride, and there are three critical parameters in this percolation in this model. You have the connectivity length for anti-chloride. So the more you put anti-chloride in the system, the more this length of patches of anti-chloride are connected. You have the maximum olivine asperity size, which is the black represented by the black arrows here. And so these two parameters actually are based on the fact that the anti-chloride is a kind of a weaker element within a harder framework. So, and the last parameter is that we actually need to break the olivine asperities. So it's a critical nucleation, critical length that you need to nucleate really a crack. So here are these three parameters. You can draw this connectivity length for anti-chloride. You can calculate it and draw this. So this has been done for 1.1 and 3.5 gigapascal. And you have also the maximum olivine asperity size here can be drawn as a function of the anti-chloride amount in the aggregate. And finally, the critical nucleation length. This varies with pressure because it scales with the stress drop, which actually ultimately scales with the confining pressure. So it inversely scales with the confining pressure. So the more you put confining pressure, the lower this critical nucleation length is. So the idea is that the olivine asperities will need to be larger than the critical blue fracture nucleation length. And these anti-chloride clusters need to be large enough to, when they dehydrate and are not able to bear any load anymore, transfer this stress to the surrounding olivine. So as a result, we have this area here that is for 1.1 gigapascal, where you can find some unstable behavior. And this will happen only for a reduced anti-chloride amount in your aggregate, while at higher pressures, you can have a larger amount of anti-chloride that would induce an unstable behavior. And so, as a conclusion for this, actually, this was one conclusion of his work is that you should not confuse the triggering mechanism for the acoustic emission, which is the anti-chloride dehydration. You should not confuse this with the material that is failing and with the failure of the material. So now I'm going to say a few words about Sarah Ingels' PhD work. And she actually was working on oceanic crust, among others, on oceanic crust eglogitization. What she did is to work on lawsonite and glaucophane aggregates, so with a various amount of lawsonite and glaucophane. And she also was investigating natural blue schists. And I'm going to show only a summary of this work in here. So this is basically your pressure. And this is temperature in kelvins. And what you have here are the stability field for these different for the minerals of these different aggregates, blue schist and also lawsonite and glaucophane. So this is why you have here the reactions have this field here, because depending on the composition, the reaction could occur earlier in temperature or lower. This is the lawsonite out reaction, and this is the glaucophane out reaction. So all this field here. And all these paths here are the PT paths the experiment followed. So they actually were done in the same way as Thomas' experiment, in that the sample were pressurized, stressed, and then the temperature was increased, and we were looking at the phases, amounts, and stresses. So there is one low-pressure experiment on the natural blue sheets, which is shown here, and it got a few acoustic emissions. These are the stars that are along this path. And there was also so three experiments on the glaucophane-rich aggregate, which are in purple, and one natural blue sheet here, and one lawsonite-rich aggregate. So the acoustic emissions again are the stars, and what you can, if I summarize with the information that we have here, is you have two or three maybe clusters of acoustic emissions. You have one that is here, and that correlates pretty well with the glaucophane out reaction, and one here that seems to correlate with the lawsonite reaction, but it's not completely clear whether it's actually always the time. And that it always occurs in the experiment to have acoustic emissions. And here, at low pressures, we got some acoustic emissions as well. So in terms of microstructure, if I can have it. Oh, yeah. Okay, so yeah, the conclusion of what I was saying is just that acoustic emissions are not specifically associated with a major fluid release, because the major fluid release should be here, and actually this is mostly with a glaucophane out reaction that she was seeing acoustic emissions. And the microstructure actually confirms this acoustic emission kind of fact. And so here, these are only the microstructures for the bulk, for the blue sheet. You can see that at 1.5 gigapascal, so only having the lawsonite breakdown, there were some acoustic emissions, but there is no visible failure, and the sample really looked like it deformed in a ductile fashion. And at 3 gigapascals, we could see omphacite grain growth, both from in-situ information, so from the X-rays, and in the microstructures that was investigated post-mortem. And this omphacite grain growth actually correlated with acoustic emissions, and these omphacites are found within the cracks that cross-cut the sample. So this led to failure, and failure is associated with on-facile grain growth. So as a summary, I am going to stop here, the coupling of the looking in situ at the reaction, the stresses, and the AE monitoring was crucial in pinpointing which reaction was doing what, or at least trying to. The dehydration with large water volumes do not necessarily induce a sample failure. Actually, the distribution of stresses within heterogeneous aggregates may be one important key. So heterogeneous meaning maybe grain sizes or minerals with different mechanical properties. And finally, some mineralogical reactions may be privileged, but I think we are far from understanding what is going on. And I thank you very much.